Hi, I'm Tim Grierson.
And hi, I am Will Leach, and this is the Grierson and Leach podcast, episode 30, here at the New Republic. Grierson, if this each one of these podcast episodes were years, we could run for the U.S. Senate.
That's exciting.
Grierson, we really got to work at your response to the opening banter.
This is the problem for the listeners out there who care about this stuff. I have no idea what Will's going to say. He's prepared these witty comments for like a week, I think, and then he just launches them on me, and I think, U.S. Senator? That gives me nothing. Yeah. That gives me nothing to work with.
And you think, what's the quickest way I could kill this?
Yes.
That's very good.
Yes.
I like that. That is interesting.
I'm like, yes, let's move forward. But now, look what's happened.
Exactly. So let's just start coming up with some witty rejoinders, because every single time, it just falls flat on its face when I try to get going with an opening joke. So anyway, moving along as usual, this is the Grierson Leach podcast. Please follow us on Twitter at Grierson Leach, and of course, email us griersonleach@newrepublic.com. Remember that I am producing the podcast now. I actually think we made a good little step forward last week. I think last week's podcast sounded pretty good. I'd like to say, I don't want to overstate this, I might be the best podcast producer that's ever lived.
You are definitely the best I've ever met. I think that's true.
So we remind you, as always, to please subscribe to us on iTunes, find us on SoundCloud and newrepublic.com, of course. And if you go to iTunes, please review us on iTunes. If you do and leave this a name of a movie to review, we will review the movie you'd like us to talk about on air and read your review, like, say, now. Today's reboot section comes from Team Stoli. Great Films Discussion, 5 stars, Team Stoli says. I found these guys on Deadspin and have been looking for a go-to film reviewer since Ebert passed and Wesley Morris left Grantland, R.I.P. Grierson and Leach are great. By the way, Wesley Morris still writes about movies. You should totally read Wesley Morris.
Yes, because he himself has not rested in peace.
He is not dead. Wesley Morris is awesome. Grierson and Leach are great. Smart film discussion and don't take themselves too seriously. Looking forward to listening to the long haul. Film review, Rear Window. So we will be discussing the 1954 Alfred Hitchcock classic Rear Window in our reboot section. There's only one today because, boy, howdy, do we have a lot of reviews. We have 6 movies to talk about that opening this weekend. Very heavy opening weekend. Now, 2 of these I have not seen. Excuse me, 3 of these I have not seen, and one of which Grierson has not seen. So we're going to try a new little bit on that one. Well, rather than I leave the room and Grierson talks about the movie he's seen that I haven't, or he leaves the room and I talk the movie that I've seen that he hasn't, I'm just going to ask questions. It'll be just like 3 key questions plus a letter grade. We're just going to ask. It's going to be like a Q&A section of back and forth. Think of it like those discussions that you have at the end of film screenings where the director's there, except you don't want to shoot yourself while it's happening. Q&As with the directors are the worst, aren't they, Chris?
That is a high bar for us to get over. Yes, I won't ask Will any questions about what the budget was, what the most challenging shot was to do, or what advice he has for young filmmakers.
What advice he has for young filmmakers. Yes, exactly. All right, so we have 2 movies, however, that we have both seen, and we're going to start those now. Our first film is Pete's Dragon.
I was out here at the Eastern Pad. But that's
50 miles east
from where we found him.
Hey.
Wait. Do you know where your parents are? Your family?
I guess he was on a picnic or a camping trip. He wandered off and got himself lost.
Been out in the woods, doing things his own way. Sounds like a boy after your own heart.
How long has he been out there?
6 years.
Nobody can survive in that forest for 6 years. At least not alone.
You'll see. I have Elliot.
All right, so Pete's Dragon is a remake. I actually had some discussion on whether this counted as a remake, a reboot. Where exactly this? I think it's a remake.
Yeah, I think it's a remake. There's no rules on this stuff, I feel like. But if you call something a reboot, there really is the idea that you're starting like a series of new movies. And I don't think this movie is really trying to be the first in 3 or 4 new films. So I think it's just a remake.
Okay, so it's just a remake of Pete's Dragon. This was directed by David Lowry, who did Ain't These Body Saints, and was the editor of Upstream Color, which is kind of an amazing thing. This guy's now is doing a remake of Pete's Dragon. It stars Robert Redford, Bryce Dallas Howard, Una Lawrence, Wes Bentley and Carl Urban as the mean old logger. that old chestnut. So basically, this is a remake of the 1977 film, but is very much of the feel of these movies these days, in that it is both a modernization and still kind of like veering back toward nostalgia. This one is very clearly, very heavily inspired by Steven Spielberg's films of the 80s, specifically the E.T. type reign, which I feel like, say what you will about J.J. Abrams, I feel like he officially started that trend. Now there's the smaller things, whatever the name of that Netflix show is, and Midnight Special, and there's all sorts of stuff going on with this. This is right in that strike zone. This is trying to do the Spielberg thing from the 80s. Basically, this is, however, like this one, basically Bryce Dallas Howard plays this basically wood marshal. She's a marshal, right?
She's like a park ranger type of
thing. Park ranger. That's the word I'm looking
for. Or wood marshal. Wood marshal.
Yes. What is Bryce Dallas Howard doing over there? Oh, she's marshaling wood.
We have to marshal more wood.
Well, it's not like she's ranging parks. I guess neither one of them really makes sense. Yeah. Anyway, so Bryce Dallas Howard plays, she is the daughter of Robert Redford, Mr. Meacham, who saw a famous dragon in the woods years before. Turns around, she comes across a young boy in the woods named Pete, who it turns out has been raised by a dragon. She quite understandably finds this skeptical, but we see in the very opening sequence, in a very, very well done opening sequence, that in fact he was orphaned in a car crash 6 years earlier, and now we're seeing him as it. Of course, it turns out she doesn't believe there's a dragon. Pete's like, there's a dragon. And of course, she learns how to become a better mother and how to keep her mind more open like her father. Meanwhile, the mean, costly, causing all sorts of trouble logger, played by Carl Urban, ends up causing all sorts of trouble, because otherwise there'd be no movie. So, Grierson, Pete's Dragon has been, I think it's very fair to say, has been a very well reviewed. It feels similar to The Jungle Book, not so much in style, but in the, hey, we're going to take this old property and we're going to shine it up and we're going to invest it with some sincerity and we're going to do this one right. Now, First off, to be very clear, I think this is very well done. I feel like it's got a particularly good soundtrack. I thought the music of this is very good. It's very sincere. Lowry's a very good director. He kind of infuses it with this kind of warm-hearted, good spirit. I have to say, though, and this is where I will go somewhat, I will definitely go astray from the critical consensus on this. My main problem with Pete's Dragon, which I think it's very well done, it tries so hard to shake its corporate roots, and I think ultimately fails, is probably the best way to put it. In that there's something about the way that the movie is not only so derivative of kind of Spielberg's 80s movies, but feels like it's going after that same sense of wonder. Why can't we all see the world like children? But it can't quite get all the way there, because this is fundamentally a story about a dragon in the woods. And I think that is one of the things I feel like there's a lot of work done. I'd love to see I made this joke in my review in The New Republic. I feel like David Lowery does something really impressive by making the best possible Pete's Dragon movie he could make. But now it's time to move away from this and go on. Now you've passed that test. Now go on and do your own personal film. So now I realize I see he's doing another Peter Pan reboot. So I can now I know that he can do that next. My general problem with Pete's Dragon is that it's, after a while, the sentiment, as sincere as it is, begins to feel a little cheap, particularly because, I kind of hinted at this earlier, the whole plot goes into motion basically because Carl Urban he's the brother of Wes Bentley, who is Bryce Dallas Howard's boyfriend. He is a mean logger that wants, she's a wood marshal. so she loves the forest. Meanwhile, of course, Carl Urban is trying to, he's a logger, he wants to destroy the forest. It's kind of this kind of Portlandy sort of conservationist idea to it. But the problem is he basically plays the role of the idiot cop in Die Hard, where every single thing that he can do wrong that will make, otherwise this movie could be resolved in like 15 or 20 minutes, but he, for whatever reason, not only has to be the mean logger guy that destroys the forest, but decides, hey, I think I'm going to go hunting and I'm going to kill whatever this thing in the forest is. And he finds the dragon, and rather than be like, holy crap, there's a dragon. We're in Portland in 1983 and there is a dragon here. He's like, oh, I must take it and steal it and sell it because he is my dragon. And I will have the people will come from the world around to come see my dragon. Amazingly, that plan does not turn out as it is. I think on the plot level, as sincere as the movie is, the plot lover feels it feels very kind of hackneyed and very kind of constructed in a way that I think undercuts what the movie is generally trying to do. So I think I don't have a lot of huge bad thoughts about Pete's Dragon, but I have to say I cannot get on board with all the love for this movie.
Yeah, it's funny because we have different reasons for being kind of reserved about this movie. I ultimately like it, but I was also a bit baffled, I have to say, in terms of how much people like it. As always, I don't like to suggest or assume why people like things. I think they just like them because they like them. But I think that this movie, to a certain degree, has the same problem that I felt that the Jungle Book remake had earlier this year. And I actually liked BFG, but when people really liked BFG, it was for the same type of thing, which is that I think people are responding to how gentle and lovely this movie is. And that adjective lovely, I think, can be kind of problematic in certain ways because this movie is very determined to not be loud. This is a movie where there are not a lot of big set pieces. There's one at the end. But other than that, there really isn't a ton of big car chases or action sequences or even like what I would consider typical family film comedy that we have nowadays. There aren't a lot of big fart jokes or snot jokes or things of that nature. This movie is very determined to be kind of a throwback. To me, it feels less like a Spielberg movie and more like a, frankly, like a live-action Disney movie of the 1970s. It's not quite as goofy, but it's supposed to, every frame of this movie, you are to watch it and think, wow, they don't make movies like this anymore, do they? It has very much that sense, and you mentioned the score, Will, and I think the score is kind of that way too, where you watch it thinking, boy, this feels like, you know, the movie is set somewhere, it's sort of an undefined, like late 70s, early 80s period. And the movie is supposed to feel old fashioned. It's supposed to feel like a throwback. And I think that certain critics have really, to my mind, over responded to that. Because for me, it's funny to hear you talk about the things that bother you in the plot. What bothers me in the plot is not so much that Carl Urban is kind of like the we've got to stop this dragon. I mean, you know, it's an old-fashioned movie because only in old-fashioned movies is the plot, I'm going to capture a big thing and people around are going to want to see the thing I've captured. Not to brag, but Will and I have both been on the planet for about 40 years. Has there ever been an exhibit of we've captured something, you have to come and see it? Has it actually happened in the real world? Because it happens in old-fashioned movies all the time. We're going to capture King Kong. We're going to capture the Loch Ness Monster. We're going to capture Pete's Dragon and do that. And I, on one level, I kind of understand that what David Lowery is doing is that that plot in certain ways is supposed to be self-consciously old-fashioned. Just the idea that the movie is about respecting the environment and respecting the forest and the idea of like, not being afraid of other creatures out there in the world, but that the dragon is, I mean, the dragon in this movie basically looks like a big dog. And so the movie really is kind of like a boy and his dog movie, except it's a dragon. And the movie really wants to be kind of like elbowing you in the rib saying, hey, look at this. We've made the type of like family film we don't make anymore. And for the most part, I'm on board with that. The problem I have is I feel like that's the ceiling for this movie. There isn't a lot of really majestic, amazing. The movie actually doesn't really kind of, you know, to use a horrible pun, kind of take flight, because to me, the movie is very much grounded in this idea of we're going to make an old-fashioned movie. And beyond that, I don't think there's a lot of inspiration in this movie. It has like its atmosphere and its tone kind of nailed. But after that, I mean, even like Robert Redford in the movie is supposed to play the old guy with like homespun wisdom who nobody believes, but gosh darn it, he's right. There is a dragon out there and we should respect him. I like the movie fine, but I find it to be just kind of operating on one level, which is not that impressive of a level.
Yeah, and not to, I still feel like Spielberg is, you downplayed a little bit, and I think you're right. It has a little bit of a Savannah Smiles, kind of like those old Disney VHS tapes that were the oversized boxes, that like those kind of like live action movies from the 80s. I think there's a little bit there. But one of the things I feel like this also doesn't rise to the level of like one of those. I feel like it's so nostalgic in that way, but it doesn't, the problem is those movies back in the day were actually a lot more challenging than this. Like, you know, like Close Encounters, I mentioned this in my review, but like Close Encounters of the Third Kind, which is a movie, I think this movie is another, like E.T. is trying to kind of conjure up a little bit, that is about a father that abandons his family. And E.T. is about latchkey kids in a, with an overworked single mother. And so like, was this movie is just about really nice people trying to do really nice things. And I feel like it wants to conjure up the world of those movies, but those movies were actually a lot more challenging and a lot more interesting than this. So we have five movies to get to, so we will not go down the rabbit hole with Pete's Dragon. Is to say that I think just about everything that you say is correct. But I have to say, I don't even think it quite rises to the level that I think that you think it rises to.
Yes, I would give it a B-.
Yeah, I give it a C+. I give it a C+. So an actual C+. So we're generally on the same line, but I am on the not recommend, and you were on the recommend. So that is Pete's Dragon. We went flying through there because we got a lot of movies to get to. But Pete's Dragon or Pete's Dog. So just think of this movie as Pete's big, huge green dog and the wood marshal.
and now let's move to the complete opposite tonally movie. We're now going to talk about Sausage Party.
Oh, yes, I'm the first to enter eternity.
Oh, potato, way to go, buddy.
The pipes are caught. Oh, Jesus, me eyes. Oh, gummy skin. She's peeling me
what
skin.
What the
Oops.
Children!
Sausage Party is the new movie co-written by Evan Goldberg and Seth Rogen, who co-wrote This Is the End and Superbad and The Interview from a couple years ago. It is, as you might have heard, an R-rated animated comedy that...
I had heard that.
You might have heard about that. And for people who are not familiar with it yet, it is about... a grocery store filled with food items that in their universe believe that when you are chosen by the gods, who are human beings, you are taken to the great beyond, which is their version of paradise. So all of the food items really, really, really want to be picked. Seth Rogen, who plays a sausage named Frank, get it? Discovers a horrible truth, though, which is that they don't go to the great beyond. They are actually eaten. The movie is about what they do with that information. We have talked throughout this summer about the fact that this has been a pretty horrible summer for big blockbuster event movies. So I don't want to overpraise Sausage Party, but I can say that of the big comedies of this summer, this is the one I laughed at the most, and it was by a pretty wide margin. For me, I think when Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg are really on with their movies, especially This Is the End, which I was a big fan of, what I think that they do well almost alone, I don't think anybody else kind of does this combination as well as they do, their movies are really raunchy, really kind of button-pushing R-rated comedies, but at the same time have a lot of smarts and a lot of heart underneath it, and I think this movie especially does. And even more so, I think, is great about this movie is that it actually doesn't lead with what the movie is sort of like about, like thematically. You can see sort of political overtones in this movie. You can see an idea of what essentially this movie, you know, I have seen Will's review, so I don't want to steal his thunder, but this movie is essentially about what happens when a whole world believes in an orthodoxy and when that orthodoxy is not true and how people do not want to let go of outdated beliefs, even though there are facts to the contrary of that. But that being said, what I think is really great is that what this movie leads with is how incredibly filthy and raunchy and legitimately funny it is. I kind of laugh from beginning to end. This movie is only about 85 minutes long, and I think it actually builds from its premise, which I described, because there's these great set pieces. I think visually, this movie does a lot of great stuff in terms of playing with like horror movie tropes and war movie tropes. And it's really
The war movie trope is my favorite
one. Yeah, it's really, really well done. And so it's much, much more than either a one joke premise or just people sitting around swearing a lot. I think this thing is really, really funny. I had an absolute blast watching it.
Yeah, I liked it too. I will say that I found it's, you know, one of the things with Rogen and Goldberg is even when they're doing like their raunchy, gross out stuff, they're always like, I think that they consider themselves using very lowbrow to do some highbrow things, a lot of things, whether they're talking about trying to do something about male friendship or whether they're trying to do something about how about Hollywood or what, like they're generally not so much that they're highbrow, but there's usually in all their movies some sort of like overarching point, overarching nostalgia, overarching message that they're trying to get to. I have to say, so this movie obviously goes very lowbrow at many points. The idea, I will not soon forget the now I think somewhat infamous food orgy scene. But to me, I think some of the better scenes actually go on. Some of the better scenes I think are less, oh, look how raunchy we're being. Like, I feel like that the scene you're talking about, which is basically a grocery cart crash where all of the foods go falling onto the floor of the supermarket, and when they and it basically looks like Saving Private Ryan. There are noodles like pouring at their insides, like yeah. Someone who doesn't realize the banana that doesn't realize his face has fallen off. Like some very, very clever moments in that. I will say that I get a little, this is where I kind of come in. The lowbrow stuff, sometimes it's a little too much. Sometimes it's a little too, oh, look how outrageous we're being. When the fact is, I think the premise of the movie is inherently funny enough that I don't know if it always needs that. And I also found the, seriously, like, there's no God at the end of all this. Basically, there's this kind of closet, not saying closet, but like this theme of like, it, like not just atheism, because really it's not just atheism, but the idea of people have a belief system and they do it to make themselves feel better. And how do you deal with those people when you know the actual truth? Which I think, you know, I think the metaphor for real life and human life and atheism in there is not necessarily something that's subtle. I found that a little less interesting. And I found the sometimes going so far over the top as to be shocking, not quite as funny. But the premise of this movie is just so inherently funny as a Pixar satire. The idea that, wow, like, okay, wow, so you find these these robots with human traits very charming, and this rat with human face and with a voice of Patton Oswalt, like very charming and very funny. Fine, let's put that to food and let's eat them and watch them destroyed. This scene, like there are like baby carrots that are chewed alive, and just it's the very premise of the movie. It is so funny and so clever that it's a joke. I really never got tired of them repeating. They find all sorts of new variations on it and all different ways to do it. I found it, and to me, one of the favorite jokes, you know, remember when we talked about Finding Dory, one of my frustrations is this constant tension in Pixar movies of, okay, how much of this is happening when humans aren't looking and how much of it is happening when, how much can they interact with the human world? This movie finds a very clever way to kind of bridge that gap, which is that every single time an actual human being injects bath salts, sure, why not? Whenever they insult bath salts, they are able to see the food talking to them, and therefore it freaks them out. And that's how they're able to affect the real world, leading to this incredible sequence late in the movie where all the food, as in often in a lot of these movies, as in like the end of Toy Story, for example, they all fight back against the humans to claim their world as personified meat. And so basically it's this great attack sequence where where they have to basically shoot everyone with bath salts so they can see them and then destroy them. And I think that is very, very clever the way they kind of do that. So the movie, ultimately, I don't think its overarching ambitions are quite as clever as they think they are. But the movie is just so inherently funny, and the concept is so inherently good that I agree. I laughed quite a bit as well.
Yeah, my only like real reservation is I actually think the Michael Cera subplot is not as consistently funny. He feels a little bit stranded, though you need certain plot things you just described in terms of the bath salts. I don't think that part works as well overall. And also, I think it has what the Pixar team has on occasion, which is when you send all your characters on a journey, it becomes slightly episodic, where now we meet these characters and now we meet these characters. And inevitably, some of the characters that they run into will be funnier than others. I really think the ending's tremendous. I mean, you mentioned the orgy, you mentioned the attack or the action battle sequence at the end. What I especially love about the ending is that it's actually kind of disturbing that you think, oh, wait, so our food could actually rebel against us and kill us if it found out what was actually going on. There's actually something kind of subversive and upsetting about the ending that they kind of just glance over in a great way. I can't think of anything funnier I saw this summer. I thought Finding Dory is a better movie overall, but this movie is really, really damn funny. I give it a very high B+.
Yeah, I gave it a solid B. I gave it a solid B. I'm going to be laughing. Just the ways that they find to just run this joke over and over and over. The poor Irish potato who thinks he's being tickled, who is being washed and thinks he's being tickled by the hands of the gods before suddenly and quite brutally learning something else. I'm sorry. That is freaking funny.
And my last thing is, as Woody Allen fans, it was so great to have Edward Norton finally have an opportunity to use his great Woody Allen impression for something in a movie, because he's been doing it for years. He is fabulous as a bagel in the movie. Very good stuff.
And Nick Kroll. I enjoyed Nick Kroll in this. I don't know if I love that character. He plays a douche, which is a little bit too obvious. Yes. But I think Nick Kroll is very funny, and I think he'd actually... I don't know that character is really that great, but I found him personally very funny as that.
It mostly made me think of his great Parks and Rec character. I think that the bad guy is a little
bit... douche.
Yeah, the douche. I think the bad guy is just sort of okay in this movie, yeah.
But he is funny as them. So that is Sausage Party. There are no Wood Marshals in it, but there are lots of... I think we're going to have some fun with the Wood Marshal thing for a while now. But there is lots of meat and bun sex. So, you know, that's not a metaphor. There's literally meats and buns.
Meats and buns, yes.
All right, so now we're going to do our little section where I'm going to ask Grierson three questions and then his review and then his letter grade for three movies. And then he's going to do the same thing with me on my one movie. So the first movie that we're going to start with is Florence Foster Jenkins.
I'm so excited. We're going to make a recording.
Bravo. It was wonderful, Bunny.
Want to try another take?
Well, I don't see why. That seemed perfect to me. When I was 16 years old, my father told me that if I didn't give up music, he'd cut me off. Of course, he didn't understand. Music is my life.
Cosme McMoon?
That's me, sir.
Maestro, this is the talented young man I was telling you about.
And let's get started.
She's remarkable, isn't she?
She can be a little flat.
Flat?
It defies medical science.
Okay, all right, Grierson. This is directed by Stephen Frears. It stars Meryl Streep and Hugh Grant. Tell us what it's about. That's question number one.
It's set in the 1940s. It's based on a true story. Florence Foster Jenkins was a New York socialite. She's played by Meryl Streep, who loved music, loved opera, and loved to sing and to give performances. But though she was a big-hearted, wonderful woman, she couldn't sing a lick. Her second husband, played by Hugh Grant, who had a mistress on the side, really loved and respected her and worked very hard to protect her, to make sure that none of the bad reviews ever got to her. He basically created a bubble where she thought she was a good singer. The movie is about when she records one of her songs and it gets out into the world and people think, oh my God, this song is so terrible, we have to see her perform. There's all this demand. She thinks because of her talent, so she throws a performance at Carnegie Hall. Hugh Grant has to decide how he's going to be able to protect her when the room is not filled with people that he has hand-selected who won't laugh at her. That's what the movie is about.
All right. So is this a straight comedy? Is there like pathos in her performance? Is this just a straight up comedy, or is there like, is she in legitimate danger of being, is this a comedy performance across the board? Is it a straight comedy? And if so, are we supposed to feel bad for her, or is there enough like vigor in her that we let it go?
You sort of hit on my kind of overall issue I have with the movie. I ultimately liked it, and I reviewed it for us for the New Republic. It's mostly a comedy, and it's supposed to be a weird kind of underdog story. It's about a woman who can't sing, but so believes in her talent, and more importantly, so believes in her own love of music, because she's not an egotist. She's not some sort of megalomaniacal fool. She's just somebody who really loves to sing and has been led to believe that she's a good singer her whole life. My issue with the movie is that it's a comedy. It's a feel-good movie. It's supposed to be inspirational so that we understand that, listen, even if you don't have a great voice, to express yourself is this beautiful thing and it should be encouraged. And I get that to a certain degree. I think for me, my issue with the movie is that the movie is very happy to exist on a feel-good, believe-in-yourself field, and that's fine. But I think that there's a darker, more interesting movie in there, which is, number one, what is our obsession? And you and I have talked about this on this podcast. What is our obsession with things that are bad? Why do we as a culture seek out bad singers, bad movies? What is it about us that we want that in our world when there's actually lots of great talents out there? And I think also number two, the Hugh Grant character does not want her to get her feelings hurt. Is that actually doing a disservice to this woman to let her live in this bubble where she does not know that people are making fun of her and think that she's ridiculous? Those two issues, I think, would make the movie sharper and richer. It doesn't have to make the movie that much darker, but I think that's a missed opportunity in the film. It's mostly a comedy.
So you make it sound like it brings up this these ideas, but doesn't follow them through almost by design. Like, are you supposed to do you feel bad for her watching the movie, or do you just like her big singing scenes? I assume everyone's like, whoa. And then by the end, they're laughing. But did you end up feeling bad for her character as played by Meryl Streep? And as, because we just this week, we did our Vulture rankings. Well, Grierson did, because I haven't seen this movie yet. Our Vulture rankings of all 494 Meryl Streep performances. Where is this on that list? Is she good in this movie? Is this a great Meryl Streep role, or is this just kind of a doodle?
She is good in this. I ranked her below, like, say, Ricky and the Flash from last August, where she also played someone, a musician and a singer. She's very good in it. She's sort of, by design, a little bit more one note, because, again, she's playing this woman who is incredibly good-hearted. She's a person that it's impossible to dislike. You don't get any pleasure in her singing badly. It's not some sort of like thing where she's a jerk and so she's getting her comeuppance. And I think that's, for me, actually what's really interesting is that Hugh Grant, I think, is the really great performance in this movie, because he plays a guy who is a failed actor who's been married to her for more than 20 years, who married her mostly for her money. But, and you know, and he has this, he's been having this affair for a long time. He doesn't even like live in the same house where she lives. But he actually really cares about her. And I think Hugh Grant gives one of his best performances in quite some time, because there is that conflict in this character who loves her in his own way, but also wants to protect her because he can see the goodness in her. It's a perfectly fine Meryl Streep performance, but I think actually Hugh Grant is the one that people will actually probably be talking about more in this movie.
All right, so last question then, what did you give it?
I gave it a B-. It's a movie that I think its target audience will like and think is very pleasing and fun. But if this movie came out during award season, we would say, boy, the real story would be a lot more interesting than what this movie is.
All right, so that is that movie. Here comes our next movie. I'm going to ask you questions about. The movie is Hell or High Water.
Y'all been here for a while?
Long enough to watch a bank getting robbed. Has been robbing me for 30 years.
They paid cash?
$200. and bills as evidence.
It's evidence if they're the bank robbers. So you go out there and you get a warrant and you come after the money that I will be using to keep a roof over my daughter's head.
All right, Grierson, this is directed by David McKenzie, who did Starred Up. It stars Chris Pine, Ben Foster, and, of course, Jeff Bridges. Tell me what this movie's about, Chris.
It stars Chris Pine and Ben Foster as brothers living in Texas who are systematically knocking off all of these banks in the same chain. And the reason why they're doing that is because they're getting back at this bank that's foreclosing on them. And so it's not exactly like they're Robin Hood, but they have sort of a emotional ulterior motive for what they're doing. Jeff Bridges plays a Texas Ranger who, would you believe it, is about ready to retire, but he is
one day left
and is interested in this case and pursues them across Texas.
All right, so is Jeff Bridges a supporting character in this movie? Is this mainly about him, or is he just following them around, but it's really about the brothers?
It's sort of like No Country for Old Men, and this is not the only way it's like No Country for Old Men, in that there's kind of these parallel stories going on. There's both sort of the good guys and the bad guys. It's mostly about Chris Pine and Ben Foster, but you also get a lot of Jeff Bridges in there as well. It's mostly, though, I would say, about the brother dynamic between these two guys. Ben Foster is an ex-con. Ben Foster is the Ben Foster character. If you've seen a Ben Foster movie, he's playing that guy in this movie where Chris Pine is, he's like the good brother, essentially. He's helping out his brother. He's always been kind of protective of his brother and always kind of watching out for him because he knows that his brother, if he's not watched, will get into trouble. It's much more kind of about their dynamic, I'd say.
All right, so this is a Western. I've seen it called a heist movie. Tell me generally what's the main thing that works in this movie and what may have held you back?
When I saw this movie at Cannes, I sort of described it as, you know, No Country for Old Men if it was directed by John Hillcoat. Now, we've talked about John Hillcoat, and I'd actually just seen Triple Nine when I had seen this movie at Cannes. I think that this movie is a very good B movie. It's very much a heist, Western, gritty thriller. You know, it has lots of amazing shots in Texas of kind of sweeping prairies. And it has that No Country for Old Men feel of the sense of vastness of Texas. This idea that people are just kind of running around doing kind of whatever they want because other than the environment and that kind of brutal landscape, there's nothing really to stop them. I think that's what's strongest about the movie. I am not as big a fan of it as I think most critics are. I think it's good. I think all three performances are pretty decent. It does feel a little derivative. It does feel, I mentioned the Jeff Bridges thing in terms about, you know, he's about ready to retire. The story of two brothers, one being good and one being bad, that's something that you've seen before. I think that David McKenzie, the director, does everything pretty darn well in this movie, but the basic building blocks of the movie are things that you've seen before. So I find myself being a little more kind of hesitant about how much I like this movie. I think it's perfectly fine, but I can't say it necessarily breaks new ground, or even the idea about these brothers trying to hit back at this bank because of what the bank has done to them. I think that's a little bit interesting. I don't think it's necessarily incredibly emotionally resonant. I don't think it kind of rewrites the rules of the genres that this movie clearly inhabits.
Okay. I have to say, the movie sounds very interesting to me as a movie I planned on seeing, but you've kind of toned me down a little bit. What did you ultimately give it?
I give it a B-. I think it's very, it's well done, but I don't see the amazing movie that a lot of people see in it.
Right, well, I'm still going to go see it, man, because it's Jeff Bridges. It's the dude. The people love the dude, Grierson.
They do love the dude. It's true.
Though I have to say, you're like it's No Country But Old Men, but directed by someone that's not as good as the Coen brothers. It's not actually the like thing that makes me running out the door. But I will go see it. It's on the list. The movie is Hell or High Water. Okay, our third movie for Grierson. This is a doozy. This is the last one that you've seen that I haven't seen. Two of these movies I'm definitely going to see. I don't know if I'm going to get to Florence Griffith Joyner or whatever the name of the movie is. It's the Olympics, man. It's on my brain. But I am going to get to Hell or High Water, and I'm definitely going to get to our next movie, which is Blood Father.
You found her.
She's coming down hard off something.
Get her into detox.
I just met the girl for the first time in years. I just don't feel like handing her over to a bunch of strangers.
Want that too?
I'm not open.
I'm so sorry.
It's good to meet your friends.
Always pick the wrong rednecks.
Come on, man. Let's go.
All right, Grierson, Blood Father star is directed by Jean-Francois Richet and stars Diego Luna, William H. Macy, Elizabeth Rahm. Oh, who cares? It, of course, stars Mel Gibson. Now, Mel Gibson, somewhat troubled guy, but certainly made his comeback in the last few years. I saw him in that last Untouchables movie and thought he was actually really bad. He really didn't feel like he even wanted to be in the movie very badly. But I did like him in The Beaver, which is a movie that has some issues, but I thought he was very good in it. First off, before we get into the Mel Gibson stuff, what kind of movie is this movie? I've heard it's like Taken, but darker. Is that an accurate representation of what it is?
Vaguely. I mean, it's about Mel Gibson playing a ex-con, recently released from prison, living in the California desert. He's trying to turn his life around. And he's reunited, basically. He gets a phone call from his long-lost daughter, who he has not talked to in years and years and years. She's in trouble because she has accidentally killed this like crime boss, drug kingpin person. So she's now on the run. She has no one else to turn to. He has to protect her. So it's kind of like Taken, but it's more about him and her on the run being chased by a ton of people.
Okay, so eventually, you know, Apocalypto is one of the movies that in the reboot section they really want us, someone wants us to do. We will be doing that when it ever actually shows up on a device. I think it's not on iTunes. You can't actually find it in America for whatever reason right now. But Mel Gibson is obviously a fascinating character in that not only is he, of course, had all of these very high profile issues, but he's really talented. I think he's a terrific director, and I think he can have a lot of power as an actor. Again, it's been a long time. I kind of liked him in The Beaver, but really, I think the last time I thought he was really good in a movie was, yeesh, I'm going back through here. Like Braveheart, maybe. Like it might have been 20 years, but I feel like he's given like this really great performance. I guess he was good in Signs. He was good in Signs. I'll give it.
He is very good in Signs. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, he is good in Signs. But he was terrible in Expendables 3, and everything else has been like Machete Kills and that sort of junk. Is he good in this movie? Did you find himself for yourself happy to see him back? Does he bring more to this than just a here's another Liam Neeson then Taken role?
I think what's probably most interesting about the movie is if you watch it, you will think about all of the tabloid terrible things that he's done, because it's very much a movie where I think 85% of the interest in the entertainment value of it is kind of the personal essay nature of it. He's playing a guy who's disgraced, trying to find redemption, doesn't know if he can ever find redemption. And you watch a character played by Mel Gibson and you think, gee, that probably hits pretty close to home to him, and he must know that. I think the performance is good. I like him in the role. I think for me, it's part and parcel with my overall problem with the film, which is that that is what the movie is. It is about the idea of Mel Gibson playing this guy, because without Mel Gibson in that role, I don't think the movie has as much poignancy. I don't think it has enough kind of oomph and gravitas, because without that component, it really is just sort of a movie about a guy protecting his daughter, getting into relatively decent like shootouts and gunfights and chase sequences with the bad guys. I mean, this very much is, you know, it opened, I think, in LA and New York and maybe a couple other places this weekend. It's going to be on iTunes and some other places like VOD pretty soon. This is one of those movies that when you have Time Warner Cable and they tell you like what movies are out, you'll see like the Pierce Brosnan movie and the Kevin Costner movie, and you'll see Blood Father. That will be another one of those movies. It's not necessarily terrible, but it's just of that ilk. The only thing that makes it interesting is because of Gibson's involvement in it.
So do you Do you watch this? Because I have to say, I watched The Expendables 3 and I watched Get the Gringo. I did see Get the Gringo. And as much as I've always kind of, there is a power, I think, to him as an actor. I think even more so as a filmmaker. I think his next movie is Hacksaw Ridge, which I think kind of early word is that it's really good. It stars Andrew Garfield. He's Malcolm's is not in the movie, but is the director of the movie. And from all reports, it seems really good, even potential an Oscar contender this year, which will be an interesting sort of subplot to see Mel Gibson doing that this year. That as if the report that came out over the weekend about The Birth of a Nation weren't enough. There's going to be all sorts of backstage politicking going on when it comes to these movies. But as an actor, do you feel like, okay, you've done this, now I'm ready to see you back? Now, maybe not. We don't need to see What Women Want too. But do you want to see like this guy as an actor again? Is there enough kind of fire in him left? Because him in his best performance, he's a little unhinged. He's a little dangerous. He's a little off, even when he's the good guy. Do you see enough of this to be like, okay, I want to see Mel Gibson back in some more movies?
Yeah, I mean, I think you hit on the head. I mean, whether it's Lethal Weapon or even like Braveheart a little bit. Yeah, I mean, he's best known for kind of going a little nuts. And what helps him, I think, as he gets older is there's more of a desperation and an urgency to a guy who's the age that Mel Gibson is now as opposed to a guy who's younger. I think that actually is what helps Bloodfather, is you do get a sense of like, this is a guy who's gone down the road a little bit and he's seen some shit. And that at his age now, just like the lines on his face, you can just kind of sense that about a character that he plays without him even opening his mouth. So yes, I mean, I wrote about this for us, I think, for Deadspin a few years ago now. I'm not going to defend anything that he's done, but it is, I feel like, in terms of time periods, how long you're kind of out there in the wild, kind of disgraced and sent away from, you know, from Hollywood. It feels like if he's in the right role or if Hacksaw Ridge is really good, I think that there would be enough in the industry of people wanting to bring him back and welcome him back. It entirely depends on if that movie is good or not. I mean, I think Bloodfather is going to be under the radar enough that I think it will get him a certain amount of gritty, pulpy B-movie genre cachet points, but it's not going to be the type of thing where people are going to go, yeah, you know what? All is forgiven, Mel Gibson, you can come back. I don't think this is the movie that's going to do that. I think a lot of that's going to depend on Hacksaw Ridge.
All right, and of course, I remind you that The Beaver was so long ago, by the way. The Beaver was so long, came out in 2011, so long ago. And of course, it was delayed. It was delayed like a year and a half, I believe, because of the next round of stuff that came up. But of course, Mel Gibson and Jodie Foster are the main characters. But the kids in that movie, the minor supporting characters, were played by the late Anton Yelchin and Jennifer Lawrence. So that is how much has changed since Mel Gibson was last in a serious movie. What did you give Bloodfather?
I gave it a C, actually. To me, this is kind of a disposable genre and entry, yeah.
All right, so our last movie to get to before we are cooking. We're going through movie. If all of our podcasts were flying through as much as we were right now, I mean, people wouldn't even notice that they downloaded. We have too many movies to get through, so we're going very quickly. So the last movie opening this weekend is Spaceman.
I got people asking me all the time, what's Bill Lee really like? You know what I tell those people?
What do you tell those people?
I tell them that Bill Lee is one hell of a fine left-handed pitcher. He's also one of the most thoughtful players I've ever met.
Did you actually say you sprinkle marijuana on your oatmeal?
No, I said pancakes.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry, Grace. And the movie is Spaceman. Spaceman is directed by Brett Rapkin and starring Josh Duhamel, Ernie Hudson, W. Earl Brown, and Sterling K. Brown. Grierson, give me some questions about Spaceman.
Okay, so question number one is, for people who don't know, who the heck is Spaceman?
Spaceman is Bill Lee. He was a pitcher in the 70s and 80s, kind of a countercultural character, kind of a crazy pitcher. He pitched for the Montreal Expos. He pitched probably his biggest, most high profile was in the 1975 World Series, in which he lost Game 7 pitching for the Red Sox against the Reds after Carlton Fisk's famous home run. But Bill Lee was this eccentric weirdo who was on the cover of High Times while he was pitching, and famously, you know, and would talk about drinking and being stoned before games. A very specific kind of 70s type of guy. Also a very specific Montreal type of guy. It's worth noting, by the way, that if there are any baseball fans or fans of baseball media listening to this podcast, there are cameos in this movie by Jonah Carey, yay, and Jay Mariotti, boo, as sports writers at the beginning of this movie. It's also produced by Eric Gagne. So it's definitely a very Montreal thing. He basically, the movie is about him late in his career, because he's always staging protests. He's a very left-wing guy. In fact, the current Bill Lee today is running for governor of Vermont, kind of, under one of those like crazy, like Jill Steinem, not even Green Party, like weird, like Rhinoceros Party sort of like joke candidates. But he's very left-wing. He was a big Bernie Sanders supporter. So he's this very kind of eccentric guy who's constantly staging protests against all of his teams. Eventually, late in his career, when he's with the Montreal Expos, he does one protest too much and ends up being kicked off the team. And the movie is really less about him as a person as it is about how much struggle he has dealing with the fact that his baseball career is over.
Which brings me to question number two. So Josh Duhamel plays Bill Lee. I have to be honest, he's never been an actor who's ever really kind of interested me. I've always found him to be kind of like not dead weight in a movie, but I just sort of feel like in general, you try to remember what movies he's in and you kind of flash, and then it kind of like flies out of your memory. So he does not strike me as somebody who I would think, oh, what a fascinating counterculture figure he would play, who's sort of grappling with this idea of my baseball career is over. What do I have left in my life? So how is he good in this?
He is pretty good. He's charismatic in a way that I've not personally found him before. I think you're right. I think he's generally this kind of like empty guy that doesn't really do much but looks pretty. He's got a kind of grizzled thing to him that I think works here. There's a kind of casual charm that he has. For the main problem is that he's not really playing a character. He's playing a series of counterculture tics. And if the movie were about this guy that loved baseball so much but really struggled with letting go of the game, that would be interesting. It's something I think we've seen before, but that would be one thing. But the movie also wants him to be the shit-stirring crazy man as well, and never quite decides which movie it is. So he's actually, I have to say though, I did like him. I feel like he's very comfortable. He's very relaxed. He seems to be perfectly happy to just play this guy as kind of the slacker that he is. That there's a little bit, like, you can see how much he loves the game, but mostly he's kind of this jackass slacker. And I think his performance actually sees Bill Lee as more of a jackass than the movie does, which I think actually speaks well to him. He's a little bit more impossible. He's a little bit more incorrigible. While the movie keeps telling us how great and charming he is, I think Duhamel, Mr. Fergie, generally, he kind of undercuts that a little bit in a way that I actually think he's pretty good. It's just that and he's at the center of every scene, so he kind of has to be pretty good. I just don't know if the movie necessarily does him a lot of favors.
And then question number three, with a movie like this, since I haven't seen it, going in, my question is always, would I rather watch this or would I rather watch a documentary or even like a 30 for 30 type of thing? Now that you've seen the movie, does it need to be a feature film or would it have worked better as like a 30 for 30?
I think it would have worked perfectly fine as a 30 for 30 and maybe even a 30 for 30 short, to be entirely honest with you, because I think that Bill Lee is an interesting character, but this is not an interesting story. It's like the movie the story that this movie is telling is not a particularly fascinating story. It kind of doodles a little bit. It wants us to look up to him, but doesn't really explain to us why. And it wants to be about a guy that has to retire and is sad about it, but doesn't really dig that deep into it. Here's the best thing I can tell you about. And also, to be entirely honest, it doesn't really get the baseball right, which is always sort of a frustration of mine. Some of it gets right. It gets the idea. Like, to me, one of the things I've enjoyed, by the way, is the number of people that love baseball that have started to come to me and be like, hey, everybody wants them is really good. They're all like finally seeing it now and like kind of coming around and seeing it. And that's a movie while baseball is a very small part of that movie, it still gets the baseball right. This is a movie, while I think it's about a guy who truly loves baseball, But I'll put it this way, and I don't want to give too much of a spoiler. Billy's still walking around alive, by the way, so he doesn't die. So yeah, about that. But the one of the last things in the movie is his narrative voiceover saying, you know, it's like they always say about baseball. You know, you spend your whole life clutching this ball, but at the end of your career, you realize it was gripping you the whole. It was the other way around, and baseball was gripping you the whole time. Which is one of the oldest chestnut quotes in all of baseball that we've all heard a million times. And this movie treats it as like this profound thing that it just stumbled across.
I blame Eric Gagne for that one. All right, so I have a prediction of what I think your grade was. Will, what's your grade?
It is a C minus. It's a C minus. It's not quite good enough to even quite get to that level.
I guessed a C. So okay, all right. So that is A Spaceman, directed by Brett Rapkin. So those are all of the new movies.
We made it through
for this weekend.
Too many movies opening this weekend.
So now let's go to the reboot section. And from 1954, we are going to talk about Alfred Hitchcock's Rear Window.
This is the apartment of a man named Jeffries, a news photographer whose beat used to be the world. Right now, his world has shrunk down to the size of this window. He's been watching the people across the way. Nobody seems to pull their blinds during a hot spell like this. He knows a lot about them by now. Too much, perhaps.
Rear Window came out in 1954. It stars Jimmy Stewart. It stars Grace Kelly. I'd be curious how many people in our audience have actually seen this movie. I'm guessing a decent amount of them have, so I'm not going to go through the plot too much, but Jimmy Stewart is a photographer who has broken his left leg and is stuck in his apartment in New York watching his neighbors with their open windows because it's so hot in New York. All the windows are open. He can see all his neighbors doing different things, and he notices that a guy across the way, played by Raymond Burr, he has an invalid wife who mysteriously disappears one day, and he wonders, did Raymond Burr kill her? That's what the movie is about. So my first question to you, Will, is I watched this movie today before we got on the podcast, and I was thinking that, you know, as much as you and I have talked about movies throughout our lives, I can't remember us ever having a conversation about Alfred Hitchcock, weirdly enough, and maybe I'm just forgetting it, but I think it probably goes without saying that I'm a big fan of Alfred Hitchcock. You are a big fan of Alfred Hitchcock. But what would you say is your favorite Alfred Hitchcock movie? Do you have a favorite Hitchcock?
If I had to have a favorite, I think there's a difference between the one that I think is probably resonates the most and the one I personally love the most. I think Vertigo is the one I think is always the one that's haunting and kind of sticks with you a lot of ways. My favorite is probably Strangers on a Train. I actually love Strangers on a Train because I love my favorite thing about Hitchcock of many, many things, but the ones that I wouldn't even say my favorite thing, but the one that always makes his movies jump out to me, the ones that I like more of, are the ones that are totally within a specific type of movie. It is a crime thriller. It is a so on, but there's so much weirder shit going on, like very quietly. Stranger on a Train is a great example of this. Just this very kind of clearly unhinged sort of guy. And while also still pointing out that the guy that he is kind of causing all the trouble for is no innocent himself. I'm a big fan of movies where the main character is a traditional leading man that you're supposed to cheer for, but is no innocent and is in fact has all sorts of troubles, which to me is one of the great things about Rear Window, is one of the great things about Vertigo, and one of the great things about Strangers on a Train. So those are the ones where he is subverting in plain sight the type of movies I think he was known for making.
Yeah, it's interesting. I would not have guessed Strangers on a Train. For me, it's actually a tough pick in terms of what my favorite is, because what I notice with his movies is that whichever one I've watched most recently might be the one. Vertigo is probably the one. It's funny, Vertigo is not my favorite, though I do like it a lot. I think that score is absolutely amazing and everything else about that movie is really terrific. But it's funny how I don't gravitate to it as much as I do Psycho. Psycho has actually grown on me in the last 5 or 10 years because it's so stripped down and perfectly made. And it's like, you know, the shower sequence, and that sequence is very upsetting, But there's other two other scares in that movie because they're not as well known that I think are actually even more powerful now because they haven't been drilled into the culture the way the shower scene has. If I had to, though, I might say North by Northwest is my favorite. And the reason why it's my favorite is because it's interesting what you said, Will, about what Hitchcock does really well. The thing I actually like about North by Northwest is it's really, really funny and really, really sexy. And it's so damn entertaining that when you watch that movie, at least when I watch that movie, I think movies don't need to do more than this. This is actually all a movie needs to do because it's not like that movie has great thematic depth or lots of like political levels to it or anything. It's just a well-made movie and you think this is kind of all a movie needs to do when it works as well as that movie does. When you were saying about subversion, of course, I think that both with Jimmy Stewart and Cary Grant, twice in his career, he had these great stars that he was able to say, let's make you a little darker, a little more kind of like sexy and suave than maybe you've been in your other movies. And let's kind of like put an audience through that. That being said, watching Rear Window today, I'd gone into it today thinking, you know, this is a really, really good Alfred Hitchcock movie. I really dig it, but it's not like a personal favorite. I walked out of it going, good God, this thing is good. And I think that's actually like one of the like the real testaments to Hitchcock. The moment you underrate or kind of like downplay one of his like considered classics, that's when it gets you. Like from beginning to end, I was just sort of stunned by just how timely this movie is. While watching, I was thinking, think about if this movie had come out during like the post 9/11, if you see something, say something era, because that movie, I mean, and of course, Disturbia, though it wasn't about that, what came out kind of post 9/11, what Rear Window, I think, gets really good, gets really right, is like a lot of people will talk about like, I think like the one sentence thing that like film scholars will say is, oh, it's a movie about voyeurism and how we're all voyeurs. And that's true. That's part of the movie, obviously. But the thing I just think that's really, really terrific is that we are constantly looking for some sort of meaning in our lives by eavesdropping on other people's lives. And that in some ways, that is the thing that gives our life meaning because we don't necessarily have it in our own lives. The entire time that Jimmy Stewart is watching through that window and watching those other people, I don't think of it as voyeurism as much as it's just this idea of, it's his own version of whether it's television or movies, that he just wants those people to entertain him. And he likes to kind of have a certain amount of power over them. Now, to a certain degree, that is voyeurism, and I acknowledge that. But I don't think I'd ever kind of grapple with this idea of how much he and eventually Grace Kelly and eventually Thelma Ritter, who is fantastic in this movie as his nurse, how much this thing that's happening, the idea that there may be a murder, to a certain degree, they're concerned about that woman and they want to bring justice to that woman, but they actually just enjoy being entertained by the idea of what's happening. And I think that maybe that was always there. And I think the last time I saw it was its restoration back in 1999 on the big screen. Watching it this time, I was just entirely blown away by how smart, forgetting like just like the construction of the story and how suspenseful it is and all of that, just on a thematic level, just how on point that is. I was pretty much blown away by this today.
Yeah, one of the things, the great little things that I think I first saw this movie. I first saw this movie. This is a movie that is always shown in film classes, like basic film classes. Like, okay, here's you know, this is, and they usually say this is about the cinema and this is about being voyeurs and this is about watching. But one of the great little things, like watching this closely for this, is how like the relationship between Jimmy Stewart and Grace Kelly is pretty like dead on. One of my favorite little quiet scenes of the movie is when she comes back from going over and snooping over there, and she's clearly excited, and the way that he looks at her, like after spending this whole movie complaining about how perfect she is, and how she just wants to be this New York socialite, and she does everything right, like basically being like a, like, dude, it's Grace Kelly, like, what the hell is wrong with you? And you see this, like, excitement that he has to see her really being into this as well, But the thing I like about that is, while that's like a breakthrough heroic moment for him, like, yes, she's just like me, that's awesome, Hitchcock is kind of aware that they're both kind of dicks.
Yes.
And I think that is really something that I did not catch on. I always thought it was more just, I certainly understood the idea the more you watch it, the more kind of guilty you, the more, like, you know, you cause your own trouble in a lot of ways, and there's kind of a creepy obsession that comes across. I think it's also there in Vertigo in his character, but I think it's definitely here as well. But also, like, they're kind, I wouldn't say that they're bad people, but what they're doing is, the way they're just kind of so casual about all of this and just mucking in other people's lives, and is, at first I wondered, like, wait, is she believing him too quickly? But then I actually realized, you see where that's going, and all three of them, there's a smarm to them that I think the movie's very, very aware of.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right, because I think that there may not be bad people, like you said, but there is sort of a judgment about them, which is really great, because they're not awful, but what they do is sort of despicable. And that the movie only sort of slowly comes to that realization kind of around the same time that I think that Grace Kelly's character figures it out. For me, a great small moment in the movie is near the end, after, in case you haven't seen this movie, I'm not going to tell you how it plays out, but that Thelma Ritter is basically asked by the police in terms of helping out. And she goes, oh, I don't want to get involved. And she pauses for a second because she realizes that she has been involved the entire time. And I think that's actually a really, I don't know how it played in 1954, but in 2016, you watch that and think, we kind of live these lives where we, like, whether it's watching YouTube videos or Instagram or Vines or whatever, where we are kind of snooping in other people's lives, and we kind of want to see people screw up, mess up, make mistakes, be humiliated in public in that way. But when push comes to shove, we don't want to be involved. Like, that's not the deal that we made. We want to be kind of safely behind the screen. And Thelma Ritter's line at the end is really, really terrific. I think that their relationship, meaning Grace Kelly and Jimmy Stewart's, is really smart, because, as you said, you think, dude, Grace Kelly totally loves you. What's your problem? I think that that actually makes sense, because there is something about that Jimmy Stewart character, because he talks about she's too perfect or she's so perfect, that there's something about that she's kind of pure in a way that bothers him, that he feels like either he's not worthy of it, or that he doesn't entirely trust it. And I think when she gets involved in helping him figure out the crime, the way he really responds to is, oh, she's willing to kind of like get her nails dirty, and she's kind of a bad person in the same way that I do. And that, in terms of a love story twist, is really, really nicely done. I would love to have been around in 1954 to see how this type of thing played out. And also, like, just the conceit of the idea of watching other people's lives and starting to make assumptions about who those people are, I think is really, really well done. There's very little music in this movie. I think that's really well done, because when the one window that he watches, the composer is playing his music during the kind of climactic sequence in the movie, it's really, really well done. Raymond Burr is awesome in this movie, with not a lot to do, but he is really, really kind of menacing and terrifying. I realized as we were watching this, we'd had two straight weeks of reboot movies where we talked about movies in which cutting up dead bodies is a central plot point. Shallow Grave last week and Rear Window this week. Like I said, the moment that you at all kind of like sleep on Hitchcock, you watch a movie like this and you think, okay, once again, newsflash, what a fantastic That's filmmaker. Good. Yeah, it's amazing how well this movie holds up after 62 years.
Yeah, I think in a lot of ways there's stuff that's even more resonant now. There's a lot more watching going on than just some guy from a window with a camera anymore.
Yeah, yeah, great stuff. And great recommendation, yeah.
Yes, thank you. So that is Rear Window. I have to say, of all the movies that we talked about, this is now the seventh movie we've talked about on this podcast. I think it's fair to say you should see Rear Window.
Yeah, it's just barely better than Pete's Dragon. Yeah, it's
barely better, and cheaper too. All right, so there we plowed through all of that, and that was pretty amazing. One of the most common complaints when I look through reviews of the podcast on iTunes is that, wow, they're really good and I really like it. I just wish that they could spend more time on each movie. Well, that's not what happened today. We apologize, but. Next week, there are fewer movies. We actually only have 3 movies to talk about next week, so that should be very helpful. The first movie is War Dogs, directed by Todd Phillips. It is a movie about gun smugglers during the last war, and Jonah Hill and Bradley Cooper. Should be an interesting movie. Next is Werner Herzog, Lo and Behold, Reveries of the Connected World, the newest Werner Herzog documentary about the internet and the series of tubes and the intertubes. There's that movie. And then our reboot section, our reboot movie is Breaking Away, directed by Peter Yates from 1979, a bicycling movie starring Dennis Christopher, Dennis Quaid, Jackie Earle Haley, Daniel Stern, and Paul Dooley. I'm very excited. Have you ever seen Breaking Away, Grierson?
I have seen Breaking Away, yes.
Yeah, I saw it years and years ago on like cable with my father on years and years ago, and really loved it. So I'm pretty excited. It's also from our general neck of the woods back in the Midwest. We're keeping it real to our people.
That's right, our peeps.
Indiana barely counts. I mean, we're obviously
Wait, Indiana? Oh, those Hicks? No.
Yeah, exactly. Not like the cool guys from Mattoon.
Yes, Illinois rules, Indiana rules. Yes, that's correct.
Indiana rules. Screw it, Bloomington. All right, Grierson, I think we did a good job on the show, even though we had to rush. I'm sorry we had so many movies, but this was like a speed round podcast for a podcast that's going to end up lasting about an hour and 15 minutes.
I think we did.
We have a lot to say, Grierson.
We had a lot to say, and I, of course, also thought the same thing. I know people always want us to go in depth.
Next week in depth, we'll be talking about a Werner Herzog movie, a Todd Phillips movie, and a bicycling movie. So we'll go in deep next week. All right, Grierson, we'll be back next week with episode 31. But mostly remind everyone to please send us an email, GriersonLeach@NewRepublic.com, and find us on Twitter @GriersonLeach if you have any questions or any thoughts or any concerns. Otherwise, we'll be back next week. Grierson, have a good one, man.
You too. Episode 31. Everyone could be here to cry. This beautiful creature must die. A death for no reason, and death for no reason is murder. You had me at meat tornado.